Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, I'm joined in studio now by one of our greatest writers, Anne Enright. Many of you will have read her books, which have been lauded and applauded right across the world. There was, of course, the Booker Prize in 2007, the Irish Novel of the Year 2008, the Carnegie Medal for The Forgotten Waltz, and the Kerry Group Irish Fiction Award for The Green Road. Well, Anne is now Ireland's first Professor of Fiction in University College Dublin here across the road. And as part of the Dublin Book Festival this week, Anne is helping to launch the International Pens Women's Manifesto in Ireland. Jeez, that's a lot about you, Anne.
It is. But here I am. It's just me.
We're delighted you're here. First of all, tell me about the Pen Women's Manifesto, because I know you're very interested in this.
Well, you know, Pen, since the 1920s, has been promoting and supporting freedom of expression and literature beyond frontiers and the power of the word to cross borders and tell the truth one way or the other. And this is a specific push from Penn to clarify their position about women's voices, women's speech, giving access, equality and parity to female journalists, female writers. And more and more important in these days where it just seems to be a combat zone with journalism, to remember female journalists and how oddly tenacious and irritating they can be to the body politic, and how badly that can sometimes end for them.
And do you think more than ever women's voices are being silenced, or are we hearing women's voices more?
I think there has been, you know, an amazing thing has happened with social media over the last 10 or so years. And so we're hearing an absolute cacophony of voices, and we're seeing people cluster in different ways. So things that were deniable are now so manifest that we don't know where we are, basically. Mm-hmm. So, and when we don't know where we are, the thing to do is the right thing consistently and well, to call out what you see as soon as you see it. And so I'm all for sort of catching that wave of female voices on that release of the human voice that has happened online, and making sure that it is, apart from anything else, safe. I mean, we see how wild it is out there, and how wild it was specifically for women. Just go beneath the line. Just go beneath the line. And, you know, words like misogyny weren't fashionable 10 years ago in Ireland. If you said misogyny, people would look at you. And now it's common. I mean, it's just incontrovertible and undeniable. And there it is every single day on our screens.
And do you think it's being corrected sufficiently? And is there a point at where it would be corrected enough?
I don't know if we have the systems in place to manage all of this yet, one way or the other. And certainly when you look at the Me Too movement and you see the backlash to the Me Too movement and you say, well, where are we going to proceed with all of that? We don't have the legal frameworks for people to speak properly or accountably. And we're just behind. We're behind in all of these. And I'm most keen that when we catch up with ourselves, it is on the basis of equality rather than of fascism, which is one way the world seems to be catching up with it all.
Do you find as a writer that it enables you to write in a way about things like you're talking about now, that it gives you a freedom being a writer that perhaps someone who can't write doesn't have a freedom to express those views?
Well, it's a great life. You are your own person, so you can call it as you see it. You have to see it. You have to be consistent and careful, I suppose, in how you do all of that. But you can flame out and die fantastically and just say whatever is on your mind. No, if you say something well, if you shape it, if you have the ability to get into people's minds in a really interesting conversation that the writer has with the reader. It is a funny, weird anti-power sort of power.
Do you enjoy writing?
I do. Well, I have to, you know, I'd have to. I mean, I was getting questions all the time about whether I write in the morning or the afternoon, or how do you do it, basically. The way you do it is you enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, you really have to stop at some stage. I mean, there are whole years where it feels like you're banging your head off a wall. I mean, perhaps even decades, but something about the sweetness of getting the right phrase in the right place. Fantastic. And if you didn't get that, sense of rightness from it, you'd really, you'd have to stop it. I've been writing for 30 years. I'd be a great fool if I didn't enjoy it.
Does it become more enjoyable, though, when you are as successful as you are? I mean, I listed there just some of the awards you've got, but that must make it, I suppose, an almost warm feeling inside that you know you have, you've made it as a writer. You don't really have anything more to prove when you sit down to write now.
Well, there's always posterity, Miriam. Also, you don't know what you've done. Also, there are the grandiosities that every writer has that you say, I have the most amazing book in my mind. You've no idea how great it is. It's the greatest book since great books were ever great. And then you've got the words on the page and there's a creative shortfall in there and they just are what they are. I think as you go on, that the pleasures of the process, you abandon your emotions to the page a little. You just let the page speak for itself. So all the things you think about success, failure, I don't know. I mean, Beckett is too often quoted on the failure business, but, fail better, just keep on failing. Yeah.
I was reading articles before I interviewed today, and one of them you said that to be a writer, you really need to be able to dream, to be a dreamer. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah. I'm really intrigued by people who can or can't, or who say that they can or they can't, or students perhaps who'd say that they feel like they're an imposter. I mean, fiction is just made up, and I'm in the business of fiction. If I'm writing factual stuff, I try and get it, accuracy is an issue. Accuracy is an issue in fiction as well. But what is it that makes our dreamings inaccessible to us, or what are the voices in your head, and how do you protect your dreaming from? I think all writers have some idea of authority, whether critical authority or a proving authority. Since we're children, we play when we're safe. Mm-hmm. And then we make something and we show our parents and we say, look at this, and they enjoy it too. I mean, so these are very primal sort of feelings about creativity. So being stuck, the way people describe all the things that go wrong for them, I'm always interested in the model they use. This is, they hit a wall. There isn't any wall. There's no wall. There's a page. There are words. There's no wall. They're stuck. What is stuck? It's not a question of digestion.
That's so interesting.
No, really. Well, is it?
If that's for anyone listening as well who is trying to write, I would imagine that's quite inspirational for them.
I've settled on this kind of model that people think that writing fiction is like flying, because they read a book and it feels like flying. But a book takes 2 years to write, or a year to write, or several months to write, and it takes a couple of days to read. So, yeah, it feels like flying when you're doing it at high speed, but the process is very slow motion. What you do with a book is you build it very slowly and very deliberately, and it's like building an airplane. And once you have built your airplane, yes, then you can fly. So it's some fantasy of immediate, it's like that somehow writing fiction would be like falling asleep and dreaming that way. But it's a different style of dreaming. I think it is, and writers get very anxious about their space and how to protect this state of flow, because you don't know what you're doing when you're doing it right. It's very hard to describe. You're in a state of flow. You're interested in the words, and the words are talking back to you. You say, well, the character had to do this, or then people say, how do your characters talk back to you? Like it's a mystical thing. Maybe it is.
Probably is a bit, actually.
Possibly is a bit. I think you have to look at your own sense of obstacles and tripping over things. And it's very easy to drop out of a text and say, this is going wrong for me. So what you need is to calm down. That's one thing you need to do. The other thing you often need to do is get over yourself. You say, this is terrible. Actually, you just feel terrible. And just go back to the manuscript and do it again.
As the professor of fiction, Ireland's first professor of fiction in UCD, is that what you say to your students?
That's my kind of posture. It's my posture.
It's good.
That's. But you say whatever the student's work is looking for. You try and you look at the work on its own terms. You say, well, okay, this is a thriller. This is, you know, fantasy fiction. What this kind of tilting one way or the other? What happens if you rebalance it in one way or another? So you actually let the work talk to you, and I think I arrived into the MA in creative writing in UEA with a big sense of the meanness of me, the wonderful meanness of me, and the, and was surprised, or I like to surprise students with the idea that actually it's about the page as much as it is about them. It's what you do rather than what you are, what you make.
Can everyone write?
Can everyone write? Write what?
Can everyone write a good novel?
A good novel.
Good fiction.
I have to say, there are a very few people in Ireland who don't want to. I mean, there are three of them at least, and they're in a pub, been miserable. No, there are at least three Irish people who don't want to write a novel. And Ireland is distinctive for that, because in Germany, people would look at you really bow-ways if you said, well, that's the thing that people want or need to do. So it is a kind of cultural disease, really, that we have to.
It's kind of a nice disease, though, is it?
It is. It's a fantastic, fantastic one. Can everyone do it? Yes, everyone can do it. Can they do it well? You know, that's what writing, creative writing courses are there to do, to help you to do it better. That question, Miriam, is about, is everybody wonderful? And yes, the answer is yes, everybody is wonderful. Is everyone extraordinary? Yes, everyone is extraordinary, especially when they dream. Can everyone produce an amazing 80,000 words? Well, they'd have to put the time in.
But I think I could sit down for the next 100 years and never write The Green Road to the Gathering. Like, in other words, some people have surely a far greater talent at writing than others.
And talent is really nothing in the long run. It's all about tenacity, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I see very talented people disappear, and I see very untalented people just get better with time and really start producing good work.
That's very interesting. Then, in other words, you can have the talent and maybe not be tenacious enough, and therefore not produce the goods.
Well, you can
goods.
Produce a nice lyric poem, because it's only, 100 words long. But if you're going to write 60, 70, 80,000 words, then that means going back day after day.
Are you a disciplined writer then?
Well, if I was disciplined, I would be a different person. I'm a constant writer. I mean, I associate discipline with getting out for a walk and it's like, moderating my life in some way. But no, I mean, I write constantly. I write pretty much every day. And if I have a book going, it's hard to stop me writing.
And I was wondering, you lived in New York for a number of years, didn't you? Then you came back here. Where was it easier to write? Are you distracted here by the constant, maybe annoying things going on a daily basis in our public world?
I could pretend that I'm not distracted.
Yeah.
I could say, oh no, I go into a room alone and I, exist in a very large way. But of course, when you're writing on a screen, the internet is there, and the internet can at times mean Trump or, and it's amazing how we're throwing our voices, some of us, or I am, and how distracting American politics is when there's so much to do and think about at home. But and there's nothing you can do to control it or alter it in any way. So, yeah, I do get, I suppose, distracted.
Did you write easier in New York than here, or the same?
Well, it depends on what stage you are at a book, with a book. It takes about a year after the book comes out and you've done all the hoo-ha and the promotion. And some little tickle, starts in your brain, and you might jot down a few notes. And I was at the note-taking stage in New York. So you do. Mm. I was teaching there and...
Did you love it?
Yeah, I liked it very much. It's a very exciting town. Mm. I mean, this town itself is a star, so you feel instantly glamorous. just being there is a glamorizing experience.
And I know your story, but remind people, at what age did you think you could be a writer? For all the people listening, even young people who think, I'd like to write.
Yeah, young people are really great because they're so stupid. I always thought I could be a writer and I thought it was
even
going
in
to be
school.
Easy. I think teachers and parents thought that I could be a writer. And I think that was something that someone of my personal style, what are we going to do with Anne? Oh, maybe she'll be a writer. And that was an answer to some vague and non-specific problem, which is great, actually. What do you do? It's a great answer. And I say it was an arranged marriage that I'm happy that people told me to be a writer and I was. And they were right.
Did you ever get a wobble along the way?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yesterday wasn't enormously steady. Actually, yesterday was good. Friday was kind of crap. Did I ever get a wobble? Yeah, I went off to the University of East Anglia, which was a creative writing course, and it was the prestige course and one of the very few courses in the mid-80s, 1986, 87. And it was being taught by one of my heroes. I mean, I wouldn't have called her a hero. I just thought she was Angela Carter and she was going to say, oh, there you are. I'd walk into the room and she'd go, there you are. And we'd have a great chat. And Malcolm Bradbury, and I was going to write an amazing book. And I didn't write an amazing book. I attempted a book that was far too amazing for its own good. And I came home with nothing, really, one way or the other. And I stayed up all night. In those days, I'd write from 8 o'clock in the evening to 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'm the kind of writer who loses words. The more they work on a piece, the more words are lost. And I come out at 12, groggy from all-nighters. And my fellow students would have said, oh, yeah, no, I wrote 500 words this morning. That very moral thing about the morning. And I'd feel that I was just disappearing down some personal drain. And yeah, that was a major wobble. Then I came home and I rattled off 4 short stories. It's funny. It is funny. Mm. I think after about 20 or 30 years, you ignore all of those, or you're able to distance to protect your creative place from those vagaries, you know, from that kind of personal weather. But there always is an element of personal weather in there.
But that probably adds to, I don't know, your creativity. I mean, all the awards you've won. And another Irish author, Anna Burns, won the Booker, of course, last month. Was it life-changing for you? And do you remember winning it that night?
I do remember winning it. Yeah, but just about, yeah. And I do remember all of that. I remembered that the world went very strange. It was like the world changed. I was entirely the same. I'd written this book 3 years previously. I was working on another book or thinking about it. And suddenly, you know, it was all trains and planes and buses. And a huge sense, which didn't last too long, but it was really interesting while it was there, of people projecting their own feelings about success and failure on you as the figure who was there, being, as it were, magically successful. So that was actually strange because you're not magic in any way. And that dizziness is really, or the opposite of dizziness, whatever it is. People had strong reactions. It was strange.
Is it life-changing in terms of career? I mean, you make the very interesting point.
You were the same person,
but in change of career.
It is, yeah, it is. Actually, I was steadily improving in career terms. And so the idea that I went from nowhere to everywhere was slightly exaggerated. And I would have, in some ways, been happy enough to continue writing my odd little books that, you know, were that tiny bit strange or too strong or, you know, not necessarily to everyone's taste. I would have been happy doing that without the feeling of meeting an audience. At the end of the year, when I was gathering my thoughts, I just thought about the audiences I had met in Australia, in, you know, Kansas. There was an Anne Teresa Enright in Melbourne. There was an Anne Teresa Enright, not in Kansas. They didn't look like me. They looked like each other, I wanted to tell. the diaspora audience, very interesting. And so I wrote The Forgotten Walls for to give them a bit of fun then after mm-hmm. that. I said, I'll write a nice adultery book for all these, mostly chicks.
Who is your typical reader? Do you have a typical reader? I don't know if that's a fair or unfair question.
Well, you can do the demographics on fiction and you'll find that it's, I don't know, 70-30 male, well, female to male. There's always a crisis about young readership, but actually that crisis never really happens. Mm. It just feels like it's all going to pot all the time. And it doesn't. It stays somehow steady. And it depends on town to town, you know. You look around in Australia and there isn't a man in the house because, you know, yeah. they wouldn't read fiction or they wouldn't be seen to read fiction. It's wonderful, this secret activity. They might read a novel. And then I remember getting a question in Edinburgh, why do men read your work? It was news to me. And I looked around the house and actually it was basically 50-50. So there are different book reading cultures in different places.
Interesting about
world.
Edinburgh, that it was 50-50.
Yeah. I think that was because I would have been seen as a bit of an intellectual writer maybe, or is that the wrong thing to say?
No.
Hard writer, bit hard.
When you start to write a novel, how do you start?
I mean, you never start. No, don't start.
Don't start.
Don't start. I mean, how can you start a novel? How can you sit down and go, it was a dark and stormy night? You just can't. You just, you know, write a bit of something and, you know, see whether it lasts until Tuesday and then write a bit of something else and see how that settles.
Yeah, but do you start with an idea, a theme?
Before you know it, you'll be looking for an idea. You say, oh, now, what am I working on now? So, yeah, you start with some words and then you look at the words and say, what's that about? Okay. And then you start building your theme and your
That's
story.
So interesting. So do you
well,
sometimes...
Well, me, you know, yeah, other so people are different.
Are different.
Yeah.
And so could your ideas develop completely differently? When you start off with certain words, would you might go in a completely different direction after a week or so?
Well, then you might throw them out or you might... Bring them into something else another time. There is a feeling of pull, you know, from certain paragraphs. And you say, there's something there. Now, what is that? It feels meaningful, feels right or significant. And you think, there's an interesting little seam. And you work on that. The first year of The Green Road was basically improvisatory. I thought, I will write. You have a big idea. I will write this big book that
book.
Everyone is going to love. Mm. And it's going to be, thank you.
And we did love it.
Well, yeah, it went out well in Ireland, very much so. It's really nice to see. So I was going to write a book about the humanitarian community. I thought that was the most interesting thing going. So I was working a lot. There's a character in the book who is a humanitarian called Emmett. And I thought that was going to be the book. And then I added in the other people. Emmett was writing home and I thought, he kept on writing home to a place with stone walls in Montbrecia. And I said, I can't be doing stone walls. I'm not doing stone walls. I'm not doing Montbrecia. But it would not go away that Emmett was in Africa and he was writing to the west of Ireland. And I was in the west of Ireland at the time. And because the landscape is just so incontrovertibly there for him in that character, then the Green Road and all of the rest of it, the place came out of it.
And all the other people and all the great characters.
And the characters and the rest of the family. Yeah.
Some of the, you used to work in TV, of course. Jeroen Cork says, as one of the tetchy production team of Nighthawks, I just wanted to say Anne was one of the smartest people I ever came across. Success at this level was inevitable.
Thank you very much. Nice to hear that.
Anne and Rachel, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the honesty of your wonderful book, Making Babies. It helps so much to know it's not all plain sailing. That's from Paula and Dartry.
Thank you, Paula.
Yeah, so.
It's nice to be of use.
That probably makes a big, I mean, obviously, you've had such big global success now, but it matters, I suppose, when individuals come up and say, that really mattered to me.
Nothing else matters, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote that baby book because I had written a book about, a little essay about having my daughter, Rachel. Mm. And there was an amount happening online of people talking about their labour experiences or whatever. I thought, oh, I could write that well. And I wrote it and a woman came up and she was crying. I thought, I've never made anyone cry. What is that? So yeah, very specifically writing into people's experience. And if someone says that book helped me in some way, I find that I just go home happy.
Because it also requires a lot of honesty on your part. And I think that's what people also connect with.
Yeah, there's different layers and types and styles of honesty. So you're trying to dig down somehow. You know, I mean, I used to be a more transgressive writer than I am now. And honesty for me was about breaking boundaries. And I'm still quite strong about naming things. I think that is, you know, I'm really interested in what we can't talk about. Even with that idea of the humanitarian community, there's an awful lot was going on in that community that wasn't known one way or the other. It's become more known in recent times. And so I'm really interested in our pieties and what is behind, what is the unnameable thing behind those. Why do we need to be pious in one way or another about, say, motherhood? What's the danger? Because if people get too pious, to use a religious word, I suppose, that means that there's something else going on. And I'm very interested in what that other thing is. And I think until we can accommodate our own difficulties, our own darknesses, until we can go there and be unafraid, then we're no further on.
Liz Nugent has said, a great writer herself, Anne Enright opened doors and made it possible for a lot of us female writers. Thank you,
Liz. Anne. Great writer, Liz.
Yeah, brilliant writer. But that's matter as well. Like, in other words, not the, like trailblazing, but in a sense, honesty and doing important and courageous things, even saying courageous things, never mind writing great books, that matters.
Yeah, yeah. It can be self-damaging to an extent. I don't encourage it in all of my... But yeah, I mean, you get an amount of, you know, you can feel personally as slightly under threat. But
did you
it's
ever?
Not really real. Well, the baby book was interesting. I was saying some complex things. I actually feel under threat most from being patronised. It's like, you know, you write a book about babies and the joy and the worry was that you wouldn't be taken seriously by serious people because serious people wouldn't read books about babies. And of course they wouldn't in Ireland. They wouldn't. That's not a serious topic.
That's
of course,
so
there's no other topic. There is no other topic. It's like one way or the other, apart from birth and death, you know, all the rest is noise, really. So, I both... You know, I played that game with my own creativity for a while.
But in the end, it stood to you. We're in a different Ireland as well. I mean, you came back from New York. We've had the referendums.
It's really hard to describe to young people what it was like. It's really hard to, you know, my daughter was saying, why did they have so many children? And you say, well, they didn't have contraception. Why did they? And the whys and the whys and the whys and the whys. And the end of that particular conversation was because they would go to hell. That was the end. Why did they do what they were told? Why? It's very hard to describe, not just those what might be legal or financial or practical matters of how people conducted their lives, but the atmosphere and what that fear was and what stopped or stops people from speaking. Very hard. It's great.
Now, it's great that they don't know any of that.
It is great that they don't know any of that. Slight pang, you know, you feel you've come through a thicket and it disappeared.
I often think of the women of our mother's generation.
Yeah.
Like, they really had it the worst of all, in a sense, because they lived in a completely different Ireland as women.
They did. There was one benefit, maybe, is that they had their expectations were not different.
Yeah.
So my generation, generation before mine, are transitional generations. And so they more than my generation, I'm in my mid-50s now, but women in their mid-60s say they took an awful lot. They took an awful lot of hits.
Yeah.
And still, I feel sometimes I'm pushed to the front to say the thing so that if there is a backlash, it'll hit me and I can take it. And I can more or less take it. But the generations coming after me have no fear. It is just amazing. They see things and they say it.
Which is wonderful.
Wonderful.
But as lots of our listeners have said, Anne, you trailblazed and did that for so
Thank
many
you.
People. It's been I could talk to you for another few hours, but I can't really. because it's national radio, but we'll chat outside. And just to say, the launch of the Penn Women's Manifesto with yourself, Anne Enright, June Constein, Frank Gehry and Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin is going to be at the Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin next Sunday at 3:45. Entry is free, but for more information and tickets, the website, of course, is dublinbookfestival.com.
Come and support it. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Anne. It was a privilege. We'll take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.